Let's Talk Outdoors is recorded on the homelands of many nations, including the Cree, Soto, Assiniboine, Dene, Dakota, Lakota, Nakota, and Métis nations on the Treaty 6 and Treaty 4 territories. We encourage you to always learn more about the stories of the land on which you live, work, and play.
I'm Derek.
And I'm Leah, and this is Let's Talk Outdoors. Today we are talking with Hugh Henry and Aditi Garg about history trail walks with the Saskatchewan History and Folklore Society.
They share their experiences with historic trail walks and about the intertwining of story, community, and place. Welcome, Hugh and Aditi. Welcome, Hugh and Aditi. Thanks for joining Let's Talk Outdoors today to talk about the historic walk and the Saskatchewan History and Folklore Society. I thought maybe we could start with hearing a bit about each of you and your story that led to you being interested in history and folklore. Hugh, maybe you could start us off.
Well, I guess my history comes through my 25 years as a museum professional. I retired in 2011 and always been interested in human history and connections to the land. Actually, in my museum career, at the end there, I got into a new facility. I was able to design some new exhibits. And the theme of the exhibits was the interconnections between the natural environment and human activity, how one impacts the other, influences the other. And bringing that from the post-glacial period up to the present day, and even using current examples, sort of projecting into the future how those interactions might take place. But I really got, in terms of the walking along historic trails, that really started in 2015 when a fellow named Matthew Anderson, who grew up in Saskatchewan, actually in Swift Current, he was teaching a course on pilgrimage studies at Concordia University. And he'd been to conferences and so on in Europe and with his colleagues and so on, talking about all the trails that crisscross all over Europe. And then he just got the idea about why not bring this back to Canada. And he was familiar with a trail that's been marked in southern Saskatchewan from Wood Mountain to Fort Walsh. And it's known as the Northwest Mounted Police Patrol Trail. And Saskatchewan History and Folklore Society, a former president got volunteers and put up physical markers along that trail back in 1961-62. And that runs about 200 miles or 320 kilometers, and there's over 200 markers marking that trail. So he knew about that, and then he contacted History and Folklore Society to see if there's any, you know, synergy there. He had an idea of maybe doing something with that trail. So our executive director put him in touch with me, because as part of my duties at History and Folklore Society and being in the southwest part of the province, I organized volunteers to go out and maintain those markers twice a year. So I'm very familiar with it. I was very familiar with the trail at the time. So anyways, the two of us got together and discussed the idea, and it kind of took off from there. And that was the first historic trail walks that we did through History and Folklore Society, again, back in 2015.
That's pretty cool.
Aditi, what got you interested in these walks, or how did you come to be involved?
I'm a relative newcomer to the trail walks. I only joined in 2021 when it was the first year post-pandemic that they did the trail walks. And I found out about it through a pilgrimage group. So I've been fascinated with pilgrimages for a very long time. I've completed the Camino de Santiago twice, and I'm planning on going back one more time in April this year. So I've been fascinated with the idea of pilgrimages, and even from my heritage in South Asia, the idea of pilgrim sites to rivers and waterways and how that connects to nature. I found it fascinating to learn that Saskatchewan had a trail walk that I didn't know about for the past 5 years. So I was excited to get to join in 2021, which was shortly after the public awareness around the unmarked graves in many sites around Saskatchewan. And Hugh and his team had put together a walk that allowed us to engage with communities along some of those sites near Fort Capel. And that was, it was a moment, it felt like an action of reconciliation for the folks on the walk, or at least for me.
So can you tell us more, Hugh, about how these walks, like walk us through how they work? Like, how do you pick the locations? How are they organized? All of those pieces, just so we can get a better picture of what happened.
Well, going back to 2015, I mean, it was a new experience for me, so I wasn't 100% sure how to go about it. And even the concept of pilgrimage was discussed heavily during the first couple of walks too, the concept of that and how, connections to our history, connections to the land, not actually pilgrimage in the traditional sense of the word, where there's a kind of a final space of some spot of some relevance or reverence, I guess, to go to. So I just again, I knew that route there, and I knew some of the people there. When we go and do maintenance, some of those markers are on privately owned land, so there's always been a matter of contacting land stewards to get permission to go out and do the work. So it's just a matter of thinking, well, how far can you walk in a day, and then where are you going to be at the end of the day? Is there a farmyard there that maybe you can call upon a good favor from a friend or neighbor to stay overnight there, and then just move along? So I learned a lot that first one. Matthew and I were again the primary movers and shakers on that, and so I mapped out the course. It's, we'll stay here at this person's place, and I contacted the land stewards, and then again going back to my museum community contacts. There's a several communities in the Southwest where I knew the people who were involved there, and I wanted to incorporate history. That was my intention, and again connecting the history to the land, and that was Matthew's understanding as well, telling that story of the Northwest Mounted Police. I mean, there's a heavy influence there, of course, from when the Lakota were in Wood Mountain area, and that whole Walsh Sitting Bull kind of experience that we all know about. So that was underlying it as well. And Matthew certainly had done some writing and some reading and some knowledge about reconciliation, and he'd done walks with the Ganawake in Montreal and so on, and engaged with First Nations community there. So he wanted to expand that as well, and again bring this history to light in this kind of forgotten part of the province, in a sense. But anyways, it was just a matter of making those contacts, setting up a schedule. That one was. I also want to do programming. Saskatchewan History and Folklore Society has a collection of slides called the Everett Baker slide, and Everett Baker was the first president of the History and Folklore Society back in 57. And through his job as a field man for Saskatchewan Wheat Pool, he took photographs, a lot of photographs, about 10,000 or so we have in our collection, of rural Saskatchewan, people doing things, going about their business, celebrations, that sort of thing, in small towns. And he spent his last years in Shaunavon, and he had a lot of photographs from the southwest part of the province on individuals and in communities. And I had access to those images, so I planned stops at McCord, for example, in Mancota, in the evenings, again through my contacts and promoting it, invited local folks to come out, and I would show them slides of the 1940s and 1950s, and of course there was family connections, and yeah, I know that who that was, and so on and so on.
Cool.
And Matthew also came out, and he also talked about pilgrimage, and he had footage. He'd also walked Camino, and he'd interview people along the Camino, and he showed some of that and some other sort of concepts of what pilgrimage is all about. And so he had a bit of a slideshow, and I had a slideshow, and that was kind of the basis of our evening gatherings. I also invited a friend of mine, Thelma Poirier, who's a historian and a poet from Glentworth, and she came out and did a reading and talked about some of the history of the area in McCord. And then moving along, I'd also planned a day off because it was 20 days in total. So halfway point is East End. And I planned a day off there and organized programming and advertised that for people to come there to East End. And as you may know, there's a lot of natural history, human history associated with that part of the country, and invited and had tours of Chimney Coulee, a Métis Ebron on site. Of course, there's the T. Rex Center. There's a very developed literary and visual arts community there, so there was connections there. There happened to be a fellow from National Film Board filming about women ranching experiences, and anyways, put programs together, and in the United Church basement, and so we showed slides, and we went out to all these different sites. I'd invited Candace Savage, who spends her summers in East End, to come out and do a reading of a Geography of Blood, which is fairly new at that time, and Jack's Cafe, which is a historic cafe in East End. So we had quite a group there. It was a nice day of programming there, and everybody had a good time. And then the next day, back on the trail, and then again, same thing, stopping along the way, connecting with the land and the history of the land, and ending up at Fort Walsh. And I, to start off the walk at Wood Mountain, I also, another little programming thing, I invited RCMP from Assiniboia Detachment, which is the Coastal Detachment, to come out and kind of kick, you know, start the walk in an official capacity, and to deputize myself and Matthew as honorary Northwest Police, and to give us a dispatch that we would deliver to Fort Walsh at the end of the walk, which would have happened. That would have happened in the day. And of course, I had made arrangements at Fort Walsh as well. So they had a troop of about six, you know, I guess employees in dress, of course. They came out of Fort Walsh, and they met us as we were approaching. And then, you know, the commanding officer and so on, we introduced ourselves and exchanged why we were there and so on. And we went into the port, and they gave us a cannon salute for making the trek and so on. And of course, there's tourists and so on hanging around, not knowing what's going on. Anyways, it was kind of a great idea. Well, it turned out wonderful in a sense. So that gave us encouragement to go on from there. And sorry for taking so much time talking about that one. It's quite special.
That's pretty cool.
I think it's really neat too. It makes the words that came to mind were something grand, because that's Matthew's blog title. So if you want to learn more about his work on pilgrimages, something grand. And I'm glad, Hugh, that you mentioned A Geography of Blood by Candace Savage. It's a great read about the history of that corner of the province. I was reading it as I took a bus of students down to Cypress Hills years ago when I was a classroom teacher. And yeah, it was a good memory. Thinking about the humps of earth that look like whales, I think she mentions at one point. The thought I was going to share is that as he was describing the walking process, and it's the speed of walking that I find really fascinating, because people have been doing that on this land for thousands of years, and everywhere on this planet, humans walked for a time immemorial before we had the last 100, 200 years of other modes of transportation. Mm-hmm. And that speed, when you're walking on the land at a slower rate, you see things and you observe things in a different way. And you can hold a conversation. I'm also a runner, but when I'm running, I'm breathing, I'm focusing on the next step. But when you walk, you can actually maintain a conversation and get to know the person next to you. And there's some magic in that when you actually slow down enough to be at a human speed, at an evolutionary mm-hmm. speed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you're also your experience with the light, with the sounds, with the heat, with the cold at night, insects, birds, animals, roadkill. I mean, it all kind of wraps up into you know, what's happening on the land as we're moving through it. Mm-hmm. Something just to add a bit of a note too on that first walk. We had a Métis fellow with us who I hadn't met until Matthew came across him. He was wanting to have a First Nations involvement with the walk, and he was introduced to a fellow named Richard Kotowich from Regina, who's Métis, and he's been adopted into a First Nations family as well. And so he was along for the first 6 days, and then of course he brought into the element of smudging as well. So we started a walk with a smudge, and just by sure happenstance and luck, I didn't even think about it, but the first day of the walk there, we walked through Wood Mountain First Nation. And it just so happened to be the weekend of the AGM and powwow. And it just so happened we got there at noon, and they were just finishing up their lunch, and we got invited in. And then we were offered a smudge by an elder. They had teepees and so on set up, and he gave us a blessing then for the rest of our walk, which was the appropriate thing to do. And these are things I've learned since then, like how, you know, First Nations, you have to have, in a sense, the question I've learned to ask is, what is your purpose for walking? And start out there. And again, some of the things that Aditi had just mentioned there about, you know, what's your personal goals? Why are you doing this? What do you expect to do? And how are you going to connect with the land and the history of the land and these other, you know, animals around you and plants and so on? And just to get back to one final note on Candace Savage, in Geography of Blood, she talks about the starvation camps at Cypress Lake. And we spent the night at one of our camping spots near the end of it at Cypress Lake on the shore there. And I read her book, and Matthew, of course, had as well. And it was very touching. We got up in the morning and smudged at the shore of the lake just to recognize that history of how many people had suffered and died there in the early 1880s because of, you know, they'd signed the treaties. They hadn't got the reserves yet. Disease, starvation were part of their everyday life until they got, relocated in the case of First Nations in the Cypress Hills area. So anyways, just some very poignant experiences that have come with every walk that we've done.
That connects well into a mandate from Sask Outdoors in 2019. We asked the government to reconsider their land access legislation and to reflect on how at that time bills 160 and 161 were going to affect how people could access land. And part of, and actually on this blog, I think, Leah, correct me if I'm wrong, but we featured someone from Treaty Land Sharing Network regarding on the podcast. Yeah. Because Hugh puts in hours of work contacting all the landowners whose land we're going to be walking across. And there should be a way that folks can respectfully access land to do the simple act of walking and experiencing the sounds and smells without interfering with production or other usage of land. And there is precedence for this in the United Kingdom and abroad. So right to roam or access to land is something that the walkers experience intimately going on these trail walks.
Mm-hmm. You talked about Fort Walsh to Wood Mountain Trek. I've heard about Fort Battleford to Fort Pitt, but so there's obviously like lots of thought that goes into creating these. Like, how do you figure about where you're going to go? How do you decide what to put together? How many walk options do you have? That's kind of like five questions in one, but.
Yeah, I told you about the first one, and the second one sort of came naturally because and 2 years later in 2017, it was this swift current to Battleford. And that was a historic trail that was opened up in 1883 when the railway came west and swift current became the closest railway link to the Battleford area, which at that time was a seat of government and quite a large population, Métis, First Nations, and white people. And before that, they had to go overland to Fort Garry, Winnipeg, to get their supplies. So after the railway came west, again, Swift Current was the closest overland link. So a trail was immediately established by the Métis in Battleford, who freighted and knew the territory because they had relatives and they were moving north-south into the States and so on. And so Goodwin Marchand was one of the Métis freighters who had a business, and there were others as well in Battleford. But he led the way for the first trek from Battleford to the railhead at Swift Current to, you know, exchange mail, pick up goods, and that sort of thing. So that trail is well established. And then it became very important 2 years later in 1885 when things were happening up in the Battleford area, and troops from Eastern Canada came west and then disembarked. It was Colonel Otter, particularly, and a number of militia regiments. And then they went overland from Swift Current to Battleford. So there's history there. And that trail actually was later on, it was actually surveyed as a road, even though it's nothing more than a trail. But I happened to have a friend of mine who's a videographer, and he was going to do a project on the trail. And for various family reasons, he wasn't able to continue with that. And he turned over his maps to me, and he had actually physically drawn the trail through his research on RM maps. And there was 10 RM maps between Swift Current and Battleford. So I had a ready-made, you know, a map showing me exactly where to go in detail, because those RM maps are in detail. So the plan was then to stay as close as possible to the trail, the story trail, you know, within a mile or 2 miles, and then just go from Swift Current to Battleford. And again, to start that one off, I have a friend of mine who's a Métis elder in Swift Current. I got her involved because of the Métis history on the trail. A friend of mine, RCMP sergeant, staff sergeant, to do a bit of a reading. We had a bit of a ceremony to start off the walk. And because of the Northwest Mounted Police then had posts along the trail, particularly after 1885, because they had, you know, lingering concerns. But in Swift Current, on the North Service Road along Trans-Canada Highway, there's a municipal heritage site. You can actually see the trail ruts as they came into Swift Current. So that was designated in the early 80s as a municipal heritage property. So that was the location where we started our walk from Swift Current. So we had some speeches, and the art gallery of Swift Current very supportively set up a Métis culture camp for 3 days on that site. And they had jigging and dancing instructors and so on. And so that was in a, once we started our walk after our speeches, then that was happening in the background, Métis music. And they'd also commissioned the production of a replica, full-size replica of a Red River cart, and had also arranged to have a woman and her horse pull the cart through from the Trans-Canada Highway through Swift Current to the north side and then out of town on the Battle of the Trail. So again, there was a lot of these, and then the same thing, I had my projector and my computer along because I had this history of the Northwest Mounted Police and the Métis, and there's a lot of newspaper articles written about the traffic, the Métis traffic between Swift Current and Valford, you know, in all the papers of the day. So I had that history, I had the military history, I had the RCMP, the Northwest Mounted Police history. And so again, I planned through my museum contacts to stop in different communities along the way. And we had a little slideshow, and Matthew brought his pilgrimage slides or talk along as well. So we stopped in five communities along the way and I'd done advertising ahead of time, and people came by, and it wasn't just a matter of saying, well, this is your history, but we also spent time to say, okay, what is your experience? You know, your homesteading families, and even on in the early homestead days too, the trail was still visible, and it was in many cases the primary route from getting, you know, north south to Swift Current or to other communities that sprung up along the, you know, along that north south axis. So again, what is your experience? What did you know? What did your grandparents tell you? So we had time for that as well, for them to share and tell us their experiences, and I was, you know, jotting down notes and names and stuff like that, trying to, you know, round up the story as best I could. So again, that was, the second was very much a similar set up in a similar way as the first trail walk. And then things evolved and we did things a little bit differently and tried to improve them as we went along.
I think that's part of the secret sauce of the walks is the community members that come out. I think on both of the walks that I've been on for the short portions, the folks who come out to just share their stories and talk about it growing up on this land, or that's the rock where I used to shell peas. That's where my grandmother's garden used to be. This is where my grandmother and grandfather or great aunt and grandmother held hands through a fence because they were on separate sides of the residential school. Like there's all these little stories and anecdotes that come out and you get that firsthand experience, and people are so generous with their time because they want, I think everyone wants to be remembered. And the reality of Saskatchewan is that rural communities are dwindling and folks want their stories to be to shared. They want someone to tell their stories to.
So what does that actually look like? Like you mentioned 20 days or 10 days, like is that, are you walking, I'm carrying all my camping stuff, I'm Sam Gamgee with, you know, everything hanging off the bag, is that we're staying at people's places, am I hoteling, what does that look like?
Well, that's one of the positive developments from the walks. The first one, with Matthew and I, we each had a van, so we actually hadn't thought about support vehicles, and we didn't have the participation numbers as we have had in the latter years either. So we were actually taking one of our vans ahead at the start of the day, knowing where we'd stop at the end of the day, coming back, starting the walk, driving back to where we started, pick up that second van. So every day we drove the distance four times and we walked it once. So on the second one, we started out that way, but some, you know, fortune, they say fortune comes from some ill effect or however that goes. But on the second walk, we had more participants. This is what the Swift Current of Battleford one. And then we had some people who were tiring, but they had a spouse or whatever that was committed to keep on the walk. So, well, I'll drive for a while. And then someone else developed shin splints. Well, I can't walk anymore. Well, I'll drive. So that started the whole process that we've had support vehicles now. Now we don't have to carry back with water and food and all that. We just put them in the back of the truck and van or whatever, and away we go, and it's much more convenient and drive so much. And so that's obviously the way it has developed up to the modern day or the latest walks, where we have people who are dedicated support vehicle drivers or switching off if they want to rest for a while and someone else wants to walk for a while. And so we always have those support vehicles with us. At the end of the day, we go back to where we're camping.
And this makes it super accessible so that anyone from any age group can join in, any ability can join in. So I'm very appreciative that it offers an opportunity to be as hardcore as you want. And if you want to carry more gear, you can. Or if you want to leave things in the vehicle, you can as well. And you can rough it, you can tent. Hugh sets up, he normally, I mean, I'm speaking for you, Hugh, but working with community organizations to find parking lots and community centers, or a list of hotels and different kinds of accommodation, or you can find your own place on Airbnb or wherever. So lots of flexibility with accommodations as well.
Cool.
And I should note too, just to clarify, they've always been come and go. Like, we've had some people just go for like half a day and some people do the whole distance. So again, it's meant to be convenient for people if they're working or whatever, or if they have other, you know, things, they have commitments in their lives, as we all do. Then, well, it's convenient then to come out for a day or two. And again, especially if you're passing through community and people are sort of last minute to get word of it and they come out and, oh, I want to, I'll join you for the next day or whatever. So again, it's very open to everybody participating at their own comfort level in terms of physical comfort level and also the schedules.
That's awesome.
Neat. You mentioned the walking speed, Aditi. And I also noticed when I was doing a bit of research for this that limericks are a part of this experience, or they are now. Can you, either of you or both of you, share how that came to be and why that's important or a part of the experience?
Well, when you're out in the hot sun, you know, for 6 or 7 hours, your mind kind of starts to wander, and you talk to the birds or you talk to the people beside you, whatever happens. But on the walk from Swift Current to Battleford, someone, I don't know who, got the idea of, we'll do haikus. And Matthew is a writer, and we had some other people, university profs in Regina, and he's a writer and so on. So they come to these things, they're English profs, and they come to these things naturally. So we start, you know, in our heads, making up haikus. So next time you stop for lunch, or you stop for afternoon break, I got a haiku, and you run it by the group. And so it's a bit of a challenge, you know, to see if you can come up with the most appropriate one. So anyways, we, at the end of the walk, we sort of jotted them down, and we've had them on the History and Folklore Society website. But again, the walk that Aditi mentioned from Fort Ellis to Fort Capel, I just got the idea that it was such a fun thing that I sort of said, well, let's do a limericks this time, and people can make up limericks. So again, those are also posted on the website.
Nice.
I think it just gives you something to think about as you're walking as well. You can take your mind off of the stone in your boot.
Or that might become part of the limerick, because that quite often is that those physical experiences, it's the blisters, it's the sun. So you're incorporating your experience into your ready. Yeah.
That's excellent. I noticed when I was looking through, particularly the Fort Battleford to Fort Pitt walking, the trail walk that you did, that's right in my backyard, it being in Lloydminster, right? Versailler and Poundmaker and Shiloh and Kenderdine and Frenchman's Butte and Fort Pitt itself. So I'm wondering if you have ever connected with, like, between education in these walks, between classes, like, you know, are there collaborative efforts that have ever happened between classrooms and educators and walks like this?
Not directly with the school system. I have made contact, and just getting back to one this past summer, the Rivers West District for Sport, Culture, and Recreation, a woman who's part of that group, a programmer, she participated in our third walk from Humboldt to Fort Carleton, just for a day. But she had heard about them, and she wanted to get the experience to see if they might work in the Lloydminster area, you know, the Prairies West District, or pardon me, the Rivers West District. Mm-hmm. And so I contacted her again last spring, I guess, to get, or even before that, probably about a year ago now, saying, okay, this is what I've got planned for the summer coming up. And would you consider promoting it, or do you want to get involved or somehow get your communities involved? And in fact, I had left it open like a year ago in January, left it open, which trail was it going to take from Battleford? Because there's one that goes north of the river, and there's one that goes south of the river. And I sort of said, okay, well, whatever response I get from communities along the way, I'll maybe use that as a base of saying, okay, I'll go this route, or I'll go this route. And it just so happened that the South communities are the ones that responded. And so I picked up on that. And I also had been to Poundmaker Interpretive Center a number of years ago, and I really wanted to include that as part of the experience. And of course, Shiloh and some of these other signature stops along the way. So it fell into place very nicely. And the Great Seder Museum community, and I visit, again, my museum experience, I visit a lot of these museums along the way. So they jumped on board right away, and they said, well, here's what we can do. We can provide a meal for you, and stopping there, and all these, you know, again, the community involved was just great. And the Seder community was just great. But getting back, okay, so there was some promotion there. I'd also contacted the radio station and the, you know, the online Westminster, exact term now, but so they did some promotion. But to answer your question, that's been one of the dilemmas in organizing these is like how big or how small, how much promotion, mm-hmm. you, how many can you accommodate in some of these halls, if you're camping in the hall and using the washrooms and so on overnight in these small towns. I mean, you know, you can do that with 10 to 15 people, but 30 to 40 people, you can't. And then just also the logistics of, you know, support vehicles and people coming and going, you know, I want to drive to a motel or whatever and come back. And so I've debated that, and people have questioned that all along. And as a sort of the manager of the experience, in a sense, or at least the day-to-day.
Right.
It was just more comfortable to keep it smaller. And so our maximum, like this past summer, we had 30, I think, and from the Fort Ells to Fort Coupelle was 30, but most of them had been from 20 to 30 in there. Mm-hmm. Come, again, that's come and go. So any one day, you might be dealing with 15 people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a nice size because you get to know folks then. I think if it was much larger, it would be really hard to have conversations. I know I personally try to spend at least one segment of walking, like an hour or two, with each person. So I want to get to know everyone that I'm walking with, and what, why they've come out to do these things. So it's not just the place where you are, but also the people that you're walking with. To your point about like the sites along the way, I just have an anecdote. My husband plays this very popular video game or computer game called Civilization. Mm-hmm. You can play different characters from history, and one of them is Poundmaker. And I've done that drive from Saskatoon to Edmonton, you know, a couple times a year, and I've never ever stopped at Poundmaker. And I told my husband, oh, we're going to this Poundmaker site, the interpretive center, and it's beautiful, it's amazing. And he couldn't believe it. He's like, what, this character from the video game? Like, he knew it was a real person, but he just like couldn't believe that this was in his own backyard, and he'd never heard of it before. But mm-hmm. there was this place that you could go and actually learn about Poundmaker and see his grave and experience the battle. They've done an amazing job there with these huge placards where you actually feel like you can see where the strategy was happening, where different camps were holding out and thinking about that spot in particular.
That's cool.
Aditi, as sort of a coming and going guest, it sounds like, on these walks, what we're curious about your experience and expectations, like if, what were you expecting going in, and then what was your experience like, and if they were the same or different?
On my drive from Saskatoon to Fort Coupelle in 2021, I was so stressed. I was so panicked and worried because I had emailed this person, this guy I didn't know, Hugh Henry. And he was like, yeah, I have a cell phone, but sometimes it's on and sometimes it isn't. And I'm a millennial techie person. And I'm like, how are you not in contact? Give me your GPS location. He's like, yeah, maybe my phone will be on. And, you know, just show up at this place and I'll be there eventually. And I get to, and I'm driving through Fort Coupelle, which is a very important part for me in my story. It's the first place I visited in Saskatchewan when I moved here from Manitoba. And so I love that valley, and I'm driving along the valley and it's beautiful and it's blue and green and everything lovely. And then I get to the site where I'm told to meet everyone, and there's no one there. And I sat there for like half an hour, and then one van shows up and they're like, are you here for the walk? I'm like, yeah. And they're like, oh, well, we're here for the walk. And then slowly all the walkers trickled in and got to know people. And it was really scary and intimidating. It was one of those moments of putting yourself out into a space where you don't know if you're welcome. And it was at Otrapway's First Nation, and I felt like I was an intruder. I'm not really sure if I should be there or not. But once I got to know the folks, and once I met everyone and got a lay of the land, it was great. And, you know, you get folks around a campfire, or, you know, all together, and someone had a guitar and there was music, and all of a sudden you all know each other and you're friends. So mm-hmm. it worked out. I don't know if I answered the question directly, but that was my experience joining in.
I'll add a bit more to that, because I had arranged for one of the head women at Otchapaways, and the place we camped there was the site of a residential, the former residential school. And it's now a camp that they have different, summer activities there and so on, but Oshapoise owns it and operates it. And so Shelley Bear, the head woman that I'd contacted and agreed that she would come and talk about the history of residential school or, whatever she chose to talk about. But we get there and they have a meal prepared for everybody. And not only that, they have orange t-shirts for everybody. And they're just welcoming like that. And then Aditi comes, she sits down and she's again at the table because we're eating just all right away. And so she's getting to know everybody at the same time. But that was a real, one of those things, unexpected. And that happened numerous times on various walks where we just were greeted with open arms in a sense, people who are happy to share their history and share their experience. And she didn't talk about, the residential school. She did talk about, about the residential school, but that wasn't her message in a sense. Here's what we're doing today. Here's all our economic opportunities. Here's what we're doing. And shared that with us as well. And so it was just a wonderful evening. And then again, along the shores of Round Lake, the environment, the setting was great as well. And just so happened this last summer, Aditi, I think you showed up at the Grace Sailor Supper too. Wasn't that your first night too?
I can't, but it was one of the first ones. Yeah. I show up when there's free food. It's somehow unintentionally. Yeah.
Hugh. So we talked a lot about the walks. Can you maybe just touch base on other things that the Saskatchewan History and Folklore Society offers beyond this programming?
Yeah, probably our signature program in a sense is a quarterly journal. It's called Folklore, and people are invited to write from their personal experience, history, and some of it goes back into the 30s, but we're gradually getting into more modern life experiences as well. That comes out to all of our members and can be purchased sometimes at various bookstores and so on. So there's Folklore, the newsletter, the journal on people's experiences, and there's poetry in there, there's photographs, old photographs and so on. But it's kind of a discussion area where people can reminisce in a sense. Also, we're the last number of years, we've really focused on newcomers and First Nations experience, including First Nations stories in folklore, but also engaging with First Nations. As an example, getting back to Everett Baker and these photographs he took in the 40s and 50s, well, he also took photographs of First Nations. And we had a number in the collection of the Wood Mountain Reserve. So one of the things that we did probably, I think it was 2017, 2 years after our walk there, I made copies of all the images that we had of the Wood Mountain Band and took them there to their AGM and offered them to them as a gift. And again, they were a sense of storytelling because there was, this is my grandparent. So that was done. We've been back to Batosh days where we had these photographs and had people come by and identify people in the photographs which weren't necessarily identified by Everett Baker at the time, even though he did a very good job in his notations of the location and the people's names and the date and so on. And the board has just approved a repatriation of photographs to Standing Buffalo First Nation on the Capel Valley. Again, Everett Baker photographs that have been, sitting in our collection in a sense, but not being, not finding a home they should have. So that'll happen this year. In this year, we'll repatriate those photographs. So it's a matter of images, stories, newcomers, having newcomers tell their stories. And since our office is in Saskatoon, our executive director is there, she's got resources and so on, people she can call on, First Nations elders. We have a youth storytelling summer camps. And so, kids can come there and learn, First Nations storytelling and again, newcomer storytelling. So those are some of our, I think, signature programs that we have. We've also, someone on our board is also a board member of NISH, help me out there, environmental history, Canadian environmental history. So there's an environment connection with some of that network in Canadian history and the environment.
Cool.
Network.
Cool.
I have not heard of this organization.
Yeah, so we're reaching out. That's a bit more academic, but again, it's making the connections that we feel are important. The people's experience in this place we call Saskatchewan, with the environment and with the communities and so on that they've lived in and they are living in today.
Neat. That sounds like a lot of different things. We'll include some. I don't know if you know about podcasts, Hugh, but there's show notes, so we'll put some links to some of those things in the show notes. A little summary of our conversation, so people can find them if they're looking for them. The theme of our season of Let's Talk Outdoors this year is connection to place. So I would like to ask both of you, what does it mean to be connected to place? And is there one place that you feel connected to that you would like to share?
Well, this wraps into some of what our discussion so far. I'm also a visual artist, and I'm quite fond of conceptual art, which people don't necessarily understand, but it's dealing with found materials, and a lot of my practice deals with history. And the last number of years, I've been dealing with reconciliation, understanding that whole concept. So I've done some of that in terms of the place where my great grandparents homesteaded, and I've taken an action. So it's not just a physical thing, but it was over 2 days in action that involved. I mentioned Richard Kotowich, my Métis friend, Regina, acting as a spiritual guide in a sense. So that's connecting, my personal interests, my personal, I guess, history, and what's happening in Saskatchewan today. So that's connecting to that spot in one example. But in terms of natural environment, like what I really get my kind of my mind-blowing experience walking on the breaks of the South Saskatchewan River. If you think about Sask Landing Provincial Park, either going east or west from there, and if you get off of the highland there and start walking through some of those river breaks, you really get a sense of what the world's all about and your place in it, your insignificance in it. And spending an afternoon doing that is pretty special.
Thanks for
sharing.
I can
smell the juniper berries as you say that. So that's a very evocative place for sure. What was the prompt again? What was the...
Our theme is connection to place. So what does it mean to be connected to place? And where is one place you feel connected to?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a first generation Canadian, so I don't have generations of stories on this land, but I do have my own memories and histories on Treaty 1 and Treaty 6. And I think I'll echo what you said about being on the river. When you first asked the question, I thought of the anecdote. We had my sister's roommate from Ontario visiting, and she said, "I want to see the prairie." We're in Saskatoon, and Derek and I grew up in the same neighborhood. So we took her to the end of Adelman. We took her to the end of the Perfect. Road in our neighborhood, and we're like, there's the prairie looking over the river in our North Saskatoon neighborhood. And she was so excited when she asked us to take photos of her jumping, and we're like, this is ridiculous. Is this the prairie? But now my family, we call that place the prairie, and we feel, and when we want to get together and feel a sense of belonging, we walk there. When my husband and I got married, we got a brick put in there. So, I think that the end of this road in Silverwood Heights, Saskatchewan, Saskatoon, on the banks of the South Sask is a place where I feel I belong. And yeah, it's a sense of connection.
Cool. That is a good place. I like that place. Is there, just as we wrap up, is there anything that you want to add? Hugh, are there walk plans for summer 2024?
Well, this is Saskatchewan History and Folklore Society has sponsored one every second year. I haven't mentioned this, but I've also done one on my own because some of our veteran walkers they like to do it every year. So I've organized one on my own away from History and Folklore Society in those intermediate years. So this is one of those intermediate years. So I've got a couple in mind. It's 150th anniversary of the signing of Treaty Number 4. So in my mind, I want to do something that will take us back to Fort Capel, not in September when the initial signing of the treaty took place, but just to commemorate somehow. But I want it to be First Nations led. And so I've got some feelers out there. some people from our past walks who know some of the community in the Papal Valley and so on. And perhaps with this connection I mentioned about Standing Buffalo, maybe something will happen over the next number of months with that, that I'll be a participant, but I won't be so much of an organizer. And also these intermediary ones too, they're much more low key. I don't do programming nearly as much. We don't visit museums and so on. It's really about the walking and the experience and not so much about the engagement with the communities. So that's in the back of my mind, whether that happens or not. And the second one is, it's also the 150th anniversary of the March West, Northwest Mounted Police. And there's kind of competing histories there. And I know that route quite well. I've gone through some of the diaries of the members who went from Winnipeg basically to Fort McLeod. And so I know the path, and that's the area I grew up in, a part of Saskatchewan, South Central. So that's in the back of my mind as well. But to be much more low key, there might be just a few of us that are involved with that, but I haven't nothing planned. But in terms of the History and Folklore Society walks, and we're going to be changing gears, I think. We want to, I'm contacting some of the past participants and asking them for feedback in terms of how things can change, whether it's shorter walks, whether, and one of the primary things is going to be more involved, but I think from, like you say, education, maybe keying in with some different groups around the province that are keyed in on education, maybe having not so much a walk from A to B, but having a center. And doing excursions, walk excursions, or experiences with the environment, experiences with the culture, but one home base for maybe 2, maybe 3, maybe 4 days, depending on the area and the interest, and then just coming back together as a group. But so we're looking at changing things up, I guess, and not so much the long historic trail runs, but experiencing the land and the history in a different format and involving more groups to participate in that and to organize it and to help and to use their experience and knowledge and connections and so on to make them real and vital and of interest to a wider audience.
Cool. Awesome. Well, it's been wonderful chatting with you both today. Thank you, Aditi and Hugh, for joining us.
Thank you.
Wish you the best as we go forward.
Thank you very much for your time.
Leah, there's lots to unpack there. There's lots of stories there. What were some takeaways from that conversation for you?
I think I had two. One was Aditi at one point was talking about finding out from the other participants what their purpose for walking was. And I immediately related that to other aspects of my life of trying to be more intentional and knowing why I'm doing things and the decisions that I'm making. And then the second one was about the word that came to mind was layering, but the layering of the human history, both settler and Indigenous folks, and the ecology. Off recording, they talked about counting birds. So just all of how they seem to intertwine all of those different parts that are at play was really inspiring to me.
Totally.
What are your takeaways, Derek?
I think a big part that I connected with there was talking about history in the community, the stories of the community, and how it's not, you know, lots of times when we think of learning about the past or learning about history or learning about whatever, it's like, you know, these pages in a textbook talk about this issue, but really Hugh and Aditi were talking about the coming together of a community to share the stories of who we are as a people, who we are as people in Saskatchewan, who we are as people of this nation, of this town, of whatever, and how much more just like how much better the understanding is and how much more awesome it is to learn about a place from that, through that lens of the people who live there, the people who have walked there. And I thought that was really cool. And I also, you know, thinking about education, I always am thinking about an education lens on this is like, how could we, create things like this where it's not in a classroom, but it's getting out onto the land. And maybe that's some sort of like mini historical walk. Maybe that's like a, in our own community, historical walk where we each do a little bit of research into something and then we do a walk and we talk about it. Or maybe we connect with a senior's home and we get some stories from them and create, like, I think there's lots of ways that this concept of a historical walk and the community that's built from it, could be woven into education. So I think that's cool. This podcast is produced in association with Sask Outdoors. Check us out online at saskoutdoors.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.